This is the Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
Welcome to the Tom Hartman Program.
Tom Hartman.
Truth in Broadcasting.
Well, the magic number seems to be 9.375. Subject to change by tenths or hundredths of a percent. Hillary Clinton won the primary in Pennsylvania. Of course, this is all proportional voting, which means that in all probability, there's still some small debate about how many delegates, all that sort of thing. But it looks like Hillary Clinton added 81 delegates to her elected delegate count. And Barack Obama added 69 delegates to his elected delegate count. Before Pennsylvania, she needed to win roughly 64-65% of all the delegates. And now she needs to win roughly 69-70% of all the delegates. Actually, the math is turning more difficult for her. The front page of the New York Times, smiling picture of Hillary Clinton saying that she believes that the tide is turning in her favor, and it's not inconceivable. By the way, welcome to the program, Tom Hartman here with you, and on this Wednesday, the day after the Pennsylvania primary, we had David Sirota on this program a week or so ago. And he wrote this op-ed, and he's got another piece out today talking about it, how in those states where the African-American population is quite small, less than 6-7%, that racial politics basically have not been part of the politics of the state. And so the white voters, the white average white middle-class working, you know, whatever voters, tend not to be so polarized, and the racist vote, as it were, tends not to show up or not to be there. And in those states where more than 18% of the electorate is African-American, there are enough African-Americans who will vote based on the basis of race, certainly not all, probably not even a majority, but there are enough that are willing to vote on the basis of race, that they at least cancel out the whites who are willing to vote on the basis of race. In other words, they cancel out the white racist vote. But then there's that group of more than 7% African-American, less than 17% African-American, more or less, those states like that, Pennsylvania falling right smack dab in the middle of that at about 14% African-American, where there aren't enough African-Americans to cancel out the white racist votes. But there are enough African-Americans, particularly involved in the political realm, that they have the white racists really rattled, really going in the state. And those are the states where racism is in play. Now, we've talked about sexism being in play. All of this, you know, arguably, I mean, you want to get into the conspiracy theories here. I mean, there are folks who have suggested to me, and I know this is out there and it's been around for a long time, that when you go back and you look at, for example, John Edwards, the last white guy, the white male in the race, that as it wasn't, when you look at the fall off in his popularity in the primary, it did not lead the fall off in coverage. It was the other way around. In other words, the networks stopped covering him as much. They stopped talking about him as much. And then a week or two later, his numbers started to decline. And there are conspiracy theorists out there who are suggesting that the networks are, you know, very Republican to their core. They want to have a Republican president. They've, you know, a pro, not just business, because the Democrats are very much pro-business, but a pro-big business, pro-transnational business, pro-defense contractor person in the White House. And so, you know, their hope was that the Republican candidate, who would certainly be a white male, would be going up against either a woman or an African-American. Either one was fine because they could take either one down based on either misogyny and sexism on the one hand or racism on the other hand. Now, that sounds like a really far out there conspiracy theory. And the first time I heard David Sirota's hypothesis, I thought, you know, racism is not that powerful in America anymore. I hope. And then and of course, you know, sexism and misogyny, you know, how powerful are they? And then you hear, you know, Rush Limbaugh with his Hillary Clinton testicle lockbox advertisements, and you hear these commentators making jokes about her being castrating, and you hear all these, I mean, the commentary, frankly, it is easier in these United States for misogyny and sexism to be used, and to be used in ways that are frankly not all that subtle, than racism. But racism is coming down the road as well. And which is not to say that Hillary Clinton won the race in Pennsylvania as the result of racism. I'm not trying to diminish her victory by this any more than I would diminish Obama's victory in, for example, Iowa or Wisconsin by saying, well, it's because there's not enough African-American, which again, would be essentially a racist statement. But I'm telling you, the Republicans, there has been an appeal to race in this. I think there's been this whole subtle, I don't know how to call it, beyond an appeal to racism. And I know on the Clinton side they're saying, hey, you know, Michelle Obama was appealing to racism to essentially saying to African Americans, come out and vote for my husband because he's African American, and she did say something similar to that at one point very early on, and then stepped way back from it very quickly. And to the best of my knowledge, that campaign has never gone there again. And then, you know, Bill Clinton's comment about, well, Jesse Jackson won the state. But again, you could argue that that was taken massively out of context. But now the Republicans are really ginning this thing up. Chris, do we have this? We've got this thing. There is an advertisement that is the North Carolina Republican Party is going to be rolling out today, attacking a pair of Democrats who are running for governor in the state. And the Republicans now are playing the race card. Here's the ad.
For 20 years, Barack Obama sat in his pew listening to his pastor.
And then wants us to sing God Bless America? No, no, no. Not God Bless America. God damn America. That's in the...
Now Beth Perdue and Richard Moore endorse Barack Obama. They should know better. He's just too extreme for North Carolina.
The North Carolina Republican Party sponsored this ad opposing Beth Perdue and Richard Moore for North Carolina governor.
So, it begins. I mean, it begins. And you think, and if Barack Obama is not the nominee, it will be a variety of things against Hillary Clinton. Certainly, you know, her misstatements, shall we say, on Bosnia. But I think even larger than that, they will be digging back into the old White House files. They'll be getting Bill Clinton parsing the word is and all these kind of things. It's not that either of these candidates don't have baggage, is the wrong word, will not face challenges given the tragic flaws that are still extant in this nation. The tragic flaws of racism, the tragic flaws of sexism and misogyny. And increasingly, as I've said a couple of times on this program, I am increasingly concerned about the extent to which people within the Democratic Party's positions are becoming hardened, and that they're going to be influencing the independent voters, and that those positions seem not to be based on the issues. They seem to be based on personality, on the charisma of Barack Obama on the one hand, or on the gender of Hillary Clinton or her association with her husband on the other hand. And what is left behind in all this? We're probably about to slide into the worst recession that we've had since the 1930s. It may well be another Great Depression. We're going to have at least one or two, and maybe as many as three Supreme Court justices over the next 4 years retire. I mean, just look at their ages. And it's going to be the liberal members of the court, by the way, and I use that word advisedly. They are certainly not liberal. The moderate members of the court. We're talking about a fundamental reformulation, a fundamental reshaping of this country. And you know, and so what is the game that's being played here? And what about the conspiracy theory? And I'll say this, I consider it a conspiracy theory that to set herself up for 2012, Hillary Clinton has to take Barack Obama out of the picture, which means let him run against John McCain and lose so that he can't be the nominee in 2012, so she can be. I mean, that sounds totally off the wall, and yet people are talking about that.
The Tom Hartman Program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy.
Our infrastructure's eroding, so what if levees break? For disasters, we're not ready. Bush thinks we'll just eat cake, 'cause a dollar is his true god. The people he'll forsake, business will carry on. Glory, glory, Halliburton. Glory, glory, Halliburton.
Yeah, business will carry on, and their guy, John McCain. And in the meantime, as we're discussing, you know, what happened last night in Pennsylvania, and as the Democratic primary is becoming progressively more and more acrimonious and positions are hardening, Admiral Fallon, who was opposed to nuking Iran, who was opposed to Bush's, you know, rhetoric about nuking Iran and you know, say, hey, you know, wait a minute, has been replaced by Petraeus as head of Central Command, CENTCOM. Basically the entire Middle East. So that now, since the head of CENTCOM was unwilling to say, yeah, let's nuke Iran, now the new head of CENTCOM will say, yeah, let's nuke Iran. Nice little circular logic there. Because Bush keeps saying, oh, even though I'm the elected president, I'm the one who's supposed to make policy, I actually say what my generals say. And then when his generals don't say what he likes, he gets rid of them and he replaces them with generals who say what he wants. So he can always pass the buck. He can pass the blame on to somebody. Oh, well, you know, my general said that. And the generals say, when you ask the generals, they say, well, we're not elected to make policy. We just do what we're told by the president. And the president says that we should do X, Y, Z. So you ask the president, he says, well, I'm X, Y, Z because my general said it. And it's, as over at BuzzFlash.com, quite a scam they got going there. It's a great way to say it. It is a great way to say it. But there are some real issues going on here. And in the Democratic primary also, you know, all this rhetoric of Hillary Clinton yesterday, the day before, that she would obliterate Iran. Are we talking about Hiroshima, Nagasaki? Are we talking about killing 10, 20, 30 million people because of something that the regime does? I sure hope not. I mean, I'm waiting to hear what that meant and where that's going. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. There's a lot on the table here today. Obviously, a lot of news, but also this Democratic primary as it's moving forward. And you know, to what extent are gender and race going to be playing into this? To what extent are all the conspiracy theories out there from the Republican corporate media saying, oh, we're gonna have a candidate that we can either use racism or sexism against, to the conspiracy theory that Hillary Clinton actually is setting up her 2012 run right now because John McCain will be too old, he'll be old and feeble by then, you know, I frankly can't imagine that she I think that some of the people in her campaign could be, but I don't, you know, I've met Hillary Clinton. I don't think that she would be that Machiavellian. I just don't. I really don't want to believe that. Joe in Detroit, Michigan, listening on WDTW. Hey, Joe, what's up? Joe, you're on the air.
Oh, hello.
Hey, what's up?
Oh, I'd like to weigh in on racism for a minute.
Please. Go for it.
Oh, okay. I'm a 73-year-old black guy. I went to school in Central Ohio, all-white school in the 40s and 50s. Couldn't go to my senior class trip because it was in Washington, D.C., and there was no place for me to stay. Welcome to America.
Yeah.
Racism is alive and well, and it will be into the foreseeable future. Alexis de Tocqueville said that nowhere was racism more pervasive and vicious than in states in which, in cities in which there were no blacks at all. So, again, racism is alive and well. This country was founded on one of the biggest myths in the world, and that's our Constitution, in which black people were considered three-fifths of a human being for Massa's voting rights.
Yeah.
So when you have a history like that, racism will... This is the most race-obsessed country in the world. I've been to several other countries. The United States really takes the cake. It even tops South Africa in terms of apartheid and the continuance of apartheid. That's unfortunate. But racism will play a part, even a larger part, I think, in the election than gender.
Yeah, you want to know, here's a statistic that in my opinion, really demonstrates the point that you're making, Joe, and that is that we are 5% of the world's population. We have 25% of the world's prisoners. And
yes,
the vast majority of our prisoners are African-American, and yet they represent a minority of our population. You tell me that is not just a crystal-clear demonstration of racism in our society.
Well, it's criminal. It is. You know, as I say, I could speak to it, you know, personally. I'm not going to say that there haven't been great changes. Unfortunately, those changes have come basically at the point of a gun, meaning Congress had to act.
In the 60s. Joe, I agree. Joe, we've only got about 15, 20 seconds here before we've got to take a break. How does Barack Obama transcend this?
Well, Barack and my brother and I, he transcends it. First of all, people forget that he's half white. White people are comfortable with Barack. He speaks their language. He was raised by white people. He's no different than anybody else. His culture is the American culture. He wasn't raised in Mississippi or Georgia or Alabama, you see. So he can move in and out of both cultures freely.
Yeah, the problem is that the Republicans run these ads where they play Reverend Wright, who doesn't, you know, who isn't perceived that way.
Well,
and they paint him with that. I mean, it's a tough one. Joe, we're out of time. Thank you for calling, though, and sharing your story with us and your thoughts. It's going to be a wild year, my friends. I say my friends. What, am I John McCain here? It's going to be a wild year. 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
I got a letter from old George W. It said, son, I hate to trouble you, but this war of mine is going bad. It's time for me to roll those dice. I know you've already been there twice, but I am sending you back to Baghdad. George W. told the nation, this is not an escalation, this is just a surge toward victory. Just to win my little war, I'm sending 20,000 more to help me save Iraq from Iraqis.
Yeah. 34 minutes past the hour on CNN right now. Roland Martin is interviewing Barack Obama. And just said, you know, the Washington Post says that you're preparing to go negative in this campaign. And he said, well, the Washington Post needs to get a new source. They need to take that source and throw them out of their Rolodex. We are going to stay to the issues. We're going to run a positive campaign. That's very explicitly, very straightforward saying that. Not true, however, of the folks who put together the Willie Horton ad. Forget the Swift voters. This is the Willie Horton people. And they have a new website, and I just got the email from them. Dear right versus left supporter, please find an important message from Bruce Hawkins, executive director of ExposeObama.com, and ask yourself, do you really want the next president of the United States to be a man with ties to known Marxists such as Frank Marshall Davis and terrorists as Bill Ayers and PLO operative Rashid Khalid? Consider the fact that Barack Hussein Obama refuses to wear the flag on his lapel and that he does not place his hand over his heart in the presence of the American flag. Consider the fact that Barack Hussein Obama embraces Jeremiah Wright, a man who has preached the most vile racial hatred and anti-American sentiment. Blah-dy, blah-dy, blah. Consider the fact that, and they go after his wife, you know, I am really proud of my country. But what really makes President Barack Hussein Obama the scariest four words in the English language is that he can become the next president of the United States. And they go on through, you know, basically this hit attack on him. And they're raising money for an ad that they want to put on television. And the ad is already out on the web, and it's flying around like crazy. And they are actually going to be, they are right now raising money to put this ad on television. And you're going to hear the audio of it. It's actually a television ad, and in the television ad, the video of it, much like the Willie Horton ads, is, although instead of showing black faces, at least, you know, they will not be accused. You can't accuse them of that. They're showing neighborhoods, urban neighborhoods, and as they have the text of these people, of what's being said. But here's the ad.
Tamika McFadden Harris, murdered leaving church choir practice, cut down by gang gunfire while shielding her 6-year-old daughter. Mike Boyd, killed at 15, beaten with bricks after a gang member crashed into his car. Severo Enriquez, just 14 years old, when he refused to flash a gang hand sign, he was shot 5 times in the back. They all died in 2001 in Chicago. The Sun-Times called it urban terrorism and demanded action on gang violence. But that same year, a Chicago state senator named Barack Obama voted against expanding the death penalty for gang-related murders. When the time came to get tough, Obama chose to be weak. So the question is, can a man so weak in the war on gangs be trusted in the war on terror? The National Campaign Fund is responsible for the content of this ad.
This is, you know, one of these peripheral groups. This is not a campaign. And here it comes. And it's very clear to me that the guys on the right are all convinced that Barack Obama is going to be the nominee. And they're trying to take him down before he even has a chance to really clearly define himself across the United States, particularly relative to John McCain. And it's becoming increasingly difficult for him to do that because there's this never-ending Democratic primary. Charlie in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, listening on WINS. Hey, Charlie.
Hey, Tom. You know, you mentioned conspiracy theories. I've been listening in the past 24 hours, and the overheated rhetoric I'm hearing from people on our side. I mean, I could put...
That was my point. It's coming from our side.
Right. Some of it's probably due to some mental illness from paranoia due to 7 years of Bush's fear-mongering and saber-rattling. But we got to take a time out here. I've heard Hillary accused of having manipulated the vote in New Hampshire. People are afraid she's going to use the Diebold machine.
Oh, I've got emails saying that she did it in Pennsylvania yesterday.
Right.
You know?
Yes, they were saying that, too. That her Iran bashing is just pandering for money from rich New York Jews. And I even heard a woman last night say on the air that she's afraid Hillary's camp will take out Obama like they did Vince Foster. It's so crazy. You hear Obama, the fear of the black man, the old racism, now this new thing that he's sort of a Manchurian candidate, a sleeper Al-Qaeda Muslim cell unto himself. People are getting so wound up with this nutty stuff. And the real issues, this illegitimate war, the economic insecurity, and the lying, that McCain is really like Bush, too. He says he's robust enough to hike the Grand Canyon, but if you look, there's an AP story. When he released his taxes on Friday, he's receiving a $58,000 pension from the Navy, a disability pension. He's disabled because of his limited body movements due to injuries as a POW.
Yeah.
So his flip-flopping on the tax loans, I won't call them cuts, and on so many other issues, immigration, this is what people on our side should be talking
and
about.
And this is for weeks now, I have been calling on the Clinton campaign and the Obama campaign to start attacking John McCain instead of each other. And let us, the voters, decide which of you can do a better job of taking down the Republican, because ultimately that's going to, you know, and demonstrating that you can govern rather than taking down the other Democrat.
Absolutely.
I mean, you're welcome, Charlie. Thank you very much. I mean, that's got to be the bottom line. In 1964, I was 13 years old. My dad was very active in the Republican Party in Ingham County, Michigan, and Lansing, Michigan, and I went door to door for Barry Goldwater in 1964. In my heart, I knew he was right. I mean, 3 years later, I was out in East Lansing getting tear gassed in the streets in anti-war demonstrations and a member of SDS. But when I was 13, I went door to door for Barry Goldwater. And I remember that convention. I wasn't there, but I watched a good chunk of it on television. And I remember Nelson Rockefeller. Nelson Rockefeller was the guy who everybody thought was going to be the nominee. Barry Goldwater was doing pretty well early on, and then Rockefeller won Oregon. As I recall, it was like in March or something. It was one of the early primaries. And that really put some wind behind his back. And then he was like 13 points ahead in California. And Rockefeller was going to take California, and that was going to seal it for him, and he was going to be the Republican nominee in 64. And a month before the primary, his second wife had a baby, Happy Rockefeller. I forget her first, her actual real name, but they called her Happy. And Barry Goldwater, now this was just like a week or 2 weeks before the California primary, Barry Goldwater started running these ads against Nelson Rockefeller, pointing out that Rockefeller had dumped his earlier wife and a year and a half later remarried. In other words, he divorced and then remarried a year and a half later, and that his second wife, Happy Rockefeller, had even given up custody of her four children in order to marry Nelson. And therefore, he wasn't a family values guy. Now, this is the kind of attack that could be leveled today against John McCain, who dumped his broke ex-wife and then within, 6 weeks or something like that, a very short period of time, married his multi-million, worth $100 million beer heiress current wife who funded his political campaigns. But nonetheless, that was the attack that the Goldwater campaign rolled out against Rockefeller. And as a result of that, that attack was so successful that Barry Goldwater won California by 2 or 3 points. So they went into the convention with Goldwater basically having it locked up, but having it locked up just 3 or 4 weeks before the convention. It was late June. The convention was in July, as I recall. I don't have all the details in front of me. But I remember, I remember that, and I do have a little bit of Rockefeller's rhetoric. Rockefeller stood up and was trying to say, come on, guys, let's pull this thing together. He said, during this year, I have crisscrossed this nation fighting to keep the Republican Party the party of all the people and warning of the extremist threat. It's danger to the party and danger to the nation. And as he said that, the convention stood up and booed. And people started shouting, "We want Barry." And Rockefeller went on to say, "These extremists feed on fear, hate, and terror. They have no program for America and the Republican Party. They operate from dark shadows of secrecy. It's essential that this convention here and now, any doctrine, repudiate here and now, any doctrine, militant, minority, whether communist, Ku Klux Klan, or birchers." And at that point, the convention stood up and booed him down to the point where he could barely speak. And then Goldwater gets up and says, "I would remind you that extremism in the defense of liberty is no vice. And let me remind you also, moderation in pursuit of justice is no virtue." Standing ovation, the convention goes nuts. But Goldwater lost the election. And I would submit to you that one of the reasons that Goldwater lost the election was because that party was split through the convention. It was split through the convention. And people look at 68 in the Democratic convention, and also with Humphrey and they also talk about Teddy Kennedy challenging Jimmy Carter and saying, "Let's change the rules." Those are great examples from the Democratic Party. I'm telling you, with both parties, every time, as far as I can tell, that this has happened, the everything goes down in flames. Michael in Hershey, Pennsylvania. Hey, Michael, we got about a half a minute here before the break. Can you, is a short one?
Hello?
Yeah, hey, Michael, you're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to repeat something Chris Matthews said yesterday in a quiet moment. He said, "For weeks now, we've known this race is over. The delegate count can't be overcome, and yet we in the press seem to be making this look like it's a race because it's in our best interest," meaning they're getting gobs advertising.
Yeah, yeah. I'm here in New York today. I don't have my computer with me, but I've got several clips of Matthews saying over the last few months, "Boy, my bosses want this thing to go on. The folks here at the network really want this thing to go on." And sure, they're making a pile of money on it. And you've got, MSNBC is owned by NBC, which is owned by General Electric, which is a big defense contractor, which is doing very well, thank you very much, in the war in Iraq.
Uncommon sense from the radical middle. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
It's nice when the postman has a letter in a sack for you, because the mail must go through.
Tom, your statement on a vote for Nader is a vote for McCain is factually inaccurate because it requires you to draw the inference that that person would have voted for a Democrat otherwise. It's disappointing to hear you say this in the case when you claim to be against the circular firing squad. It's kind of a radical statement. Thanks.
about today's guest. I believe Al Gore's comment about debate was debate within the scientific community. And secondly, to follow up his comment about not closing debate, remember, gravity, the debate's not over.
Yeah, we get mail. If you want to leave a voicemail, if you want to comment on our comment line, the number is over at TomHartmann.com. Click contacts, and the number's right there. Sarah Haley Merriam is with us, and Sarah, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Tom. How are you?
I'm well. You were working with SEIU in Pennsylvania yesterday, watching the polls, basically.
Yeah.
And I wanted to just check in and find out, you know, how did things go in Pennsylvania?
I was canvassing more than poll watching. I was really disappointed in what I kept hearing from voters. We were handing out flyers with a number to the Board of Elections, instructing people to call that number if they didn't know where their polling locations were. And I spoke with a woman who had been calling the number repeatedly for 96 hours and hadn't gotten through. And so I called it the day of the primary, and it went straight to voicemail. And so that was one instance of what was going on. And even from there, we spoke with voters who had gone to their polling location and their votes weren't being registered, and they reported it and were told that this had been a problem that had proliferated throughout the day. We spoke with voters who had been waiting in lines to vote in precincts where the polling location, where the machines were broken, and these voters ultimately ended up being turned away and weren't offered provisional ballots. I spoke with one man who was a registered Democrat for the last 28 years and was told that he needed to renew his party affiliation in order to have participated in the primary. So he was also turned away. And so at the end of the day, I can't help but wonder what are we going to do, or what is it going to take before we start really working to legitimize this process?
It was very
disheartening.
Yeah. So the primary was rather dysfunctional. Was this an area that was largely going to be going either for Obama or for Clinton? And did you hear? Is this right across the board across Pennsylvania, these kind of problems, or was this limited to a particular geographic or ethnic area?
My understanding was that League of Conservative Women indicated that the problems had occurred throughout the state. I was in Western Philadelphia, and I heard from one voter that the local news had reported that three polling locations had broken machines, and voters were just being turned away. And so from what I saw on the ground, and this, again, was because I was in an Obama area, the problems were definitely affecting people who would have been voting for Obama.
Yeah, and so presumably will ultimately in the election, regardless of who the Democratic nominee is, they've got a mess there in Pennsylvania.
Yes, it was an absolute mess. And in the morning things are pretty quiet, so I was feeling hopeful, but as the day progressed, it was really, we were just being bombarded with all these stories.
Yeah. Sarah Haley Merriam with the SEIU and working with SEIU in Pennsylvania yesterday. Sarah, thanks for the report.
Yeah, no problem.
And
thanks
the heads up. Great talking with you. Interesting. David in Pittsburgh. Hey, speaking of Pennsylvania, hey, listening to WPTT. Hey, David.
How you doing, Tom?
Just fine, but I'll get better. What's up?
Okay, listen. I can agree with some of what your guest just had to say, even though I haven't heard any local reports of machines breaking down and so forth over the local talk shows here. And perhaps maybe that's because I haven't tuned into all of them yet. But I have something to say about the demographics here.
Mm-hmm.
Something on CNN last night that the black voting bloc was only 10% of the whole population here in Pennsylvania. Let me tell you something. Here in Pittsburgh, there's a place called Wilkinsburg. There is Pittsburgh, north side of Pittsburgh, East Liberty, west side of Pittsburgh. There's Wilkinsburg.
You're getting redundant, David. What's your point?
The point is that there's a whole lot more black people in just this town alone than was represented on John King's magic board last night.
Yeah.
He had board.
Isn't the African American population for Pennsylvania 14% of the electorate?
Say that again?
I think it's 14% of the electorate. It falls into David Sirota's more than 7, less than 16 or 17%
notch. I think that's is mighty low, buddy. If we go back to the 2000 census, which I do not have in front of me, you'll find that the demographics is much different than what's purported. And another thing I'd like to add.
Well, that suggests, David, that the suggestion that's made that African Americans are only voting for Barack Obama because he's African American ain't true, because he didn't win last night.
Well, the thing about voting,
at least not in Pittsburgh.
The thing about voting for Barack Obama here in the city of Pittsburgh is such that if you believe that people are simply voting for Barack Obama because they're black and he's black, then you got a hole in your head.
Yeah, well, that was my point. I don't think that it's racial. I think that there is and thank you, David, for the call. I think that there are a small number of white people who are voting in a fairly racist way and a small number of black people who are voting in a fairly racist way. But a number of women who are voting in a gender way, and a number of men who are voting in a gender way. But hopefully, and this is where we really need to elevate the rhetoric here and start taking this to John McCain, hopefully we can move this thing forward to the extent that it's going to continue to be dragged forward by the media and by the Clinton campaign, and they have every right to, and in fact, if they really see an end game, they really see an opportunity to win, should carry it forward. But nonetheless, to the extent that it's being taken forward, let's take it forward into John McCain's face. Let's take it forward into the Republicans' face, rather than taking it forward into the face of the Democratic opposition. We're seeing a replay here of the 64 Republican convention, of the 68 Democratic convention, of the, you know, whatever year it was that Carter and Teddy Kennedy had it out. And I mean, it's just and 1980, you know, the 80 Democratic convention. This is, frankly, in my opinion, just not a healthy thing, and we need to redirect the attention toward McCain. 57.
You're in the Democracy Zone. Democracy with Zone. Tom Hartman.
The Tom Hartman Program. Program. Welcome to the vast radical middle conspiracy. Accept no imitations. Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. Terry Jeffries with us. He's the editor-in-chief over at CNSNews.com. And Terry, the headline. First of all, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom.
The headline at the top of Huffington Post last night, and the winner is John McCain. And I'm guessing, you know, folks on your side are smiling pretty widely right now.
Well, I do think what happened yesterday was bad news for the Democratic Party. I think that since February, Senator Clinton has exposed some real weaknesses in Senator Obama that could hurt the Democrats in the general election campaign that weren't there, really, before February. And now they're apparent. I think particularly he's demonstrating a weakness with precisely the kind of swing voters that decide national elections. Those are church-going Democrats in the North, in states like Ohio and Pennsylvania. In February 19th, Tom, in Wisconsin, those voters went for Obama. Yesterday in Pennsylvania, they decisively went with Senator Clinton.
And to the extent that if these attacks had come from a Republican, they wouldn't have the potency that they do coming from a Democrat. Is that the point you're making?
Well, you know, I don't think you can blame it all on Senator Clinton. I think the two stories that I think particularly were harmful to Senator Obama were his long association with Jeremiah Wright and some of the things that the Reverend Wright has said, and then this comment he made at a fundraiser out in San Francisco about bitter people in small towns in Pennsylvania clinging to guns and religion and anti-immigrant sentiment. Now, you know, that he did those things, and those stories didn't happen earlier. The Reverend Wright story could have come out earlier, and I think it might have changed the dynamics of some of the campaign. I think that Obama had basically almost locked in the Democratic nomination by the time those things came out. And, yes, Senator Clinton has exploited them to drive a wedge between Senator Obama and more conservative.
But aren't these
Democrats
really pathetic issues, Terry? I mean, the first is guilt by association. I mean, what was the last time as you were walking out of church, you shaking hands to your pastor, that you said, oh, by the way, you know, I don't get here every Sunday. Have you ever said anything that I should be worried about?
You know, well, you know what? I do think that is legitimate issues to ask why he was in this church for 20 years, baptized his children there, and so forth, considering the very offensive.
But there's like two or three pieces of video where Wright is going off in ways that, it, frankly, in my opinion, taken out of context, look really bad or sound really bad. Over a 20-year period, I mean, this is the guy, this, frankly, I mean, you talk about Hillary Clinton, this was one of the guys that Bill Clinton brought to the White House when he had his
right.
come-to-Jesus moment around Monica Lewinsky a spiritual advisor.
And I think, actually, Tom, that and the remark in San Francisco, and another reason why...
But the remark in San Francisco, Terry, was also true.
Well,
I mean, that was the basis of Tom Frank's book, What's the Matter with Kansas?
Well, I differ with you there, but here's a contrast, and I think it gets right to the politics of it. A good thing that happened for Senator Obama in Pennsylvania was that Senator Bob Casey Jr. came out, emphatically endorsed him, campaigned around the state with him. Bob Casey showed how a Democrat can win statewide in Pennsylvania. He's a pro-life Catholic Democrat. There were a number of those that Rahm Emanuel, quite frankly, ran in the 2006 election, who were elected in more conservative districts, particularly in the North.
Right. Although when you go back and you look at the 2006 election, you find that those Democrats who ran as progressives and as old-fashioned Democrats typically used less money and had greater success than those Democrats. And in many cases, you had the conservative Democrats running and actually not making it or having to use enormous amounts of money to succeed. The number of Democrats who won as progressives was greater than the number of Democrats nationally who ran as conservatives.
Well, and I think it depends. I think it depends on the district. And clearly, you know, if you're running for Congress from Philadelphia, you can be much more liberal than someone who's running from central Pennsylvania. But the political point is, and I think Democratic leaders understand this, that the swing vote that will decide the election is in places like Iowa and Wisconsin and Missouri and Ohio and Pennsylvania, where President Bush really pushed hard to try and win in 2004. He lost, but he did win in Ohio. And what Senator Clinton has demonstrated is that swing vote, which is culturally conservative Democrats, are alienated from Obama at this point. And if he can't get them back, that's going to hurt him. That's no doubt it's going to hurt him in the general.
But they're going to be alienated from Hillary Clinton as well, don't you think?
I mean,
you guys are going to go after her with every, you know, everything you've got.
Well, I think that's true, and I think that, in fact, I think that is, that's the question. Is, you know, is if
is there a viable Democratic candidate this year? Is that what the Republicans are asking themselves?
Well, no, I think the Democrats have the upper hand, and they're most likely to win the White House. But if the Republicans have a chance, the Republicans would not have a chance if they could not separate Senator Clinton from culturally conservative Democrats. But if they think they have a chance of doing that, it's now demonstrated by what's happened over the last couple of months, they'd have a much better chance of separating those voters from Barack Obama. The economy and national security are separate issues.
Well, I'm not sure that that's true, because there has been a negative campaign run against Barack Obama. There has, by and large, not been a negative campaign run against Hillary Clinton. Mm-hmm. I mean, it would have been so easy for Barack Obama during that debate to simply, you know, drop some bomb about, you know, Bill Clinton and Monica Lewinsky or what was going on.
Right.
You know, when she talked about her experience in the White House, he could have said, yeah, you know, but he just didn't go there. You know,
well,
he just didn't go there. He's not that kind of person. He's not going to get down in the gutter there. There has, by and large, I know that some of his surrogates have said some things and done some things that he has disavowed later or you know, they shouldn't have been done. But I would say, by and large, there has been this piling on against Barack Obama, including by ABC and George Stephanopoulos, who owes his political fortunes to Bill Clinton. And there hasn't been that piling on. Maybe early on there was. You know, Saturday Night Live did that, you know, the funny little skit about it on Hillary Clinton. And some of that may just be the front runner status. But let me take it to a bigger frame here, Terry. How are you guys going to successfully, how are the Republicans going to successfully run John McCain for president in a year when we're sliding into a recession, what may even be a depression? And his solution to this is to cut taxes in a way that is going to increase dramatically the for example, United Health Group, the company that paid William McGuire, their former CEO, $1.78 billion. I mean, these health companies hire people to turn down claims so that they can pay their CEO over $1 billion,
mm-hmm.
and they're going to get a $710 million tax cut under McCain's program.
Well, Tom, first of all, I just flat out concede to you, this ought to be a Democratic year. This is the year the Democrats should win the White House. Part of that is because the state of the economy. You know, we had a very close election in 2004 when the economy was doing pretty well, and people who voted on the economy voted for Kerry over Bush. But on the economy, McCain is not going to win it. I think on the cultural issue, McCain will win it, but that leaves the...
But what do you mean by cultural issues?
Are you talking about
racism or sexism?
No. I'm talking about, you know, Barack Obama, for example, as a state senator in Illinois, repeatedly opposed legislation that was, in the end, actually identical to the Born Alive Infant Protection Act that Barbara Boxer, Hillary Clinton, Ted Kennedy supported, that merely said a baby who survived an induced labor abortion would have to be treated as a person under the law. He opposed that in Illinois. He is as pro-abortion as anybody who's ever run for president. He favors repeal of the Defense of Marriage Act, which...
Terry, nobody's pro-abortion. Nobody is pro-abortion. Well, that's scurrilous.
Well, look, there's no, in terms of legislative agenda and what he's willing to support, there's no one who's been more in favor of legalized abortion than Barack Obama. He is more in favor of legalized abortion than Hillary Clinton. He favors the repeal, as he says, of the Defense of Marriage Act. He is way out there to the left of the culture, Tom. And my view is, I think the Clintons, one of the smart things about their politics, and I do believe they're opportunists, but I think they recognize that the Democrats have often lost elections nationally because they're too out of touch with middle American culture. They've tried to find a politics for the Democratic Party to deal with that problem. I think Senator Obama will not be able to deal with that problem, but I don't think that means the Republicans win.
So we're going to be back to a debate about abortion and flag pins and God and gays.
No, I think the Democrats have already lost that in this election cycle. I think what they're riding on is the fact that they're better positioned on the economy and on the war.
No, but what I'm hearing you say is that those are the issues, those are the issues that I just named, you know, the guns, gays, and God, basically. That's going to be, the Republicans are going to trot that thing out again and try and pull that trigger again.
The Republicans already win on that issue. I think that voters in Pennsylvania and Ohio and places like that who care about cultural issues, and there's a lot of them, including Democrats.
But aren't the cultural issues like, hey, we've got 40 million people without health care, 1 in 10 children in America lives in poverty?
Well,
aren't those cultural issues?
But see, that's the argument. I think what you're making is what the Democratic candidate is going to have to say is, please come to me because what you think about the economy and the war in Iraq, not what you think about these cultural issues. Which means, I believe, Tom, in the end, it's going to come down to a debate about Iraq. And if McCain cannot win that, he won't win. If Obama can't win that, he won't win. That's very interesting.
I think it's going to be the economy, and we're both talking about culture stuff. Terry Jeffrey, editor-in-chief at CNSNews.com. You can read all about it over there. Thanks, Terry.
Thank you, Tom.
The Tom Hartman Program, where smart people get their news.
I'll be rolling down a hill like a snowball headed for hell.
Are we talking about the Democratic Party here?
With no kind of chance for the flag or the Liberty Bell.
Or McCain?
I wish a Ford and a Chevy would still last 10 years like they should.
They're actually starting to again.
The best of the free life behind us now. The good time's really over for good.
No, they're not, Willie.
Stop rolling downhill like a snowball headed for hell. Thank you, Willie. Stand up for the flag and let's all ring the Liberty Bell. Let's make a Ford and a Chevy would still last 10 years like they should.
And we are now.
Because the best of the free life is still yet to come. The good times ain't over for good.
See, there you go. That's my take on it. The good times are not over for good. We still have a positive future in this country. Okay, here's and a tip of the hat and great thanks to Sean Taylor, my producer, who is doing just a great job there in Portland. I'm here in New York and compiling information for me. The Clinton-Obama campaign, roughly 55-45. Hillary Clinton, 1.2 million votes. Obama, a little over 1 million votes. Clinton has won at least 66 delegates, Obama 57. There are still 35 to be awarded. Clinton, Obama had spent $11 million, Clinton $4 million. But, you know, what's that going to mean for money? The Republican Party, how are the Republicans looking at this? I am seeing the Republican attack machine gearing up hugely. We've played for you the Republican Willie Horton ad. You just heard Terry Jeffries talking about, oh, Barack Obama was voting. You know, he's the most pro-abortion guy in the Senate in Illinois. You know, when he was there, the ad that ran before that I shared with you is Barack Obama. You know, it was the Willie Horton ad. It was Barack Obama voted not to prosecute the teenage gang violence people as adults or whatever it was. I mean, they actually never even came out and said what it is, except that he was weak on gang violence and therefore he'll be weak on the war on terror. I mean, they're already working aggressively, spending millions of dollars in huge media efforts to take down Barack Obama. The question, are they doing this because they believe that he's got it in the bag and he's going to be the Democratic nominee, and they are in a race now to define him before he can define himself? Or are they doing this because they would rather run against Hillary Clinton and they want to help her take him down in the next couple of primaries, so that they can have a race between Clinton and McCain, which McCain has said publicly that he would prefer to have, that he would much rather run against Hillary Clinton, and that he thinks that she would be easier to beat than Barack Obama? Or is it both? I mean, it's a twofer for them. But I'm telling you, the Republicans are gearing up like crazy here. And they're gearing up not against Hillary Clinton. I haven't heard a peep about Hillary Clinton from the Republicans. It's all been against Barack Obama. Why? Marcy in Seattle. Hey, Marcy.
Hi. Tom, this is my first time calling into any radio show, so you'll have to forgive me for being nervous. So.
That's okay. Thank you for calling.
Well, I'm calling in to shed a little light on the subject of race and gender, and I would add class have been playing out in our American electoral politics. And I'll just begin by identifying myself as African American. I'm also Native American. My people come from Oklahoma, so I think I share a unique perspective as a woman as well. And race relations basically began in the New World when the Dutch and the French and the Anglos and the Iberians decided to leave their perfectly adequate homelands and bring Africans with them here for free labor while they got free land from Indians. And it all intertwines. You're familiar with the term plantation mentality, are you not?
Sure.
Well, I think it operates, and it plays out today, just as effectively as it did during the slave era. And at the top of the pyramid is the white master, and in today's vernacular, we call him the man. And he lives in the big house, and he controls all that he sees. First and foremost, his capital. Then comes his woman, because this is the source of his heirs, and then the black man, who the latter needs to be made to fear. And then at the bottom is the black woman, followed by Indians. And the man controls his woman by instilling fear into her of the black man's imagined animal attributes. So he doesn't end up with a bunch of half-castes for heirs, because that wouldn't work out very well. And unfortunately, trying to control the bodies and the minds of his subjects only has served to make the man confused.
Yeah, I think, Marcy, you've done a good job of describing the strata of America. We just have like 20 seconds left here before we've got to take a break. I'm curious, what do we do about it,
The problem is that we have to, religion and propaganda is in America, which is based in racism. It is sexual lasciviousness, interestingly. It's the undercurrent that controls all this, and so we just have to come to grips with our past, and we have to overcome our obsessions with black and brown boogeymen and guns and violence and homosexuals and abortion.
Yeah.
And the lifestyles.
I think to some extent the Democratic Party is really working to do that. Uh-huh. And on the other side, you've got guys, the Republicans going, oh, look out for those immigrants! They got brown skin.
Well, and Michael Moore is 1 minute take on it, and Bowling for Columbine is just brilliant.
You're absolutely right. Marcy, I have to wrap it up. Thank you for the call, though.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Oh, it's magic. Never believe it's not so. It's magic.
34 minutes past the hour. The Tom Hartman Radio Program here on Air America Radio. TomHartman.com, AirAmerica.com, and 866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Jerry in Lansing, Michigan, my hometown. Hey, Jerry, what's up?
Hey, Tom, good to talk to you. We miss you back here.
Well, thank you.
Hey, I think that Hillary Bush and Bill Rove are actually doing what has been the playbook for the Republicans. It's the divide and conquer, and the cultural divide. You know, on these emphasizing not the issues, but emphasizing anything that's a wedge, and that goes to race and religion, as they've done in this.
And even gender, as a last caller was talking about, you know, men controlling women. I would say that the whole abortion debate, to a large extent, has to do with that.
Or in just referring to, you know, trying to get women to vote because she's a woman.
Right.
But they have as their allies the GOP and the media and John McCain, and they're all, as you pointed out, you know, that what is it that John McCain and Clinton have in common? Well, they're both D.C. politicians. They both are backed by big money PACs and corporate America. They both use GOP tactics, Bush and Karl Rove, and Rove is even now an advisor to McCain, and I'm not sure he's not an advisor to Clinton.
I would be very surprised, Jerry.
Well, I think that...
Although Richard Mellon-Scaife endorsing her, just, you know, my eyes bugged out.
They're using the same playbook. I mean, they really do look like... And when you throw in Pennsylvania and the questionable machines and what's going on, it looks like Bush from 2000 and 2004.
Yeah.
So I think... And they've also become very close to them now. I mean, I don't know how you have scruples and you take people that have trashed you and then you make them your ally.
Let me flip this around, Jerry.
Yeah.
You know, clearly you don't think that Hillary Clinton is your candidate, and apparently I'm assuming that Barack Obama is.
Tom, look, my first candidate was John Edwards.
Mine too.
I thought he had the
and Dennis Kucinich. You know, absolutely. But we don't have John Edwards or Dennis Kucinich.
But the bottom line is we do have Supreme Court justices that are going to be directing pointing the direction of this country for the next 10
no,
to 30
I, you
years.
No, I understand, and that's not where I'm going with the question.
Okay.
Let me just flip this around, though, and just ask you, as somebody who just, you know, spent the better part of 2 minutes and 40 seconds taking apart Hillary Clinton, let's assume that she's the nominee. What would you say to somebody, you know, what's your elevator speech for Hillary Clinton?
I don't have one, Tom.
I think we have to develop one.
Okay, here's my take on this, okay? I think if we continued to back the same old tactics and the same old machine, because I don't really think that we're voting for anybody different than if we vote for John McCain, and I wouldn't vote for him. I would have in 1999, not today. Okay, so we are where is our ability to say none of the above? Because
we don't have it, Jerry. I mean, just the way the Constitution was organized.
We have Ralph Nader, and that's who I'll vote for.
Yeah. Okay. So if Hillary Clinton is the nominee, you would vote for Ralph Nader.
If they steal it from Obama, and I think that's what it's going to take, and I think we will fall back into the media picks our candidate, and then we get only one choice, and that's the media's choice, and that's the GOP's choice, and that's big money's choice. If we back her, we're doing nothing more than what we've done in the last elections, and I don't want to back the same old crap.
There is, and I understand at a lot of levels, particularly with regard to, you know, corporate and you know, being on the board of Walmart, et cetera, I don't disagree. However, the Supreme Court is at play here,
and who do you think she's going to pick if she's from corporate America?
It is at least going to be less toxic than whoever John McCain picks, and I, you know, come on, Jerry, you have to acknowledge that.
Well, I really don't, because if John McCain has taken some of the stands he has, then it might be.
But Ralph Nader is not going to win.
Well,
there's no conceivable way that Ralph Nader's going to win.
I can't, in good conscience, vote for someone who's nothing more than a Republican in Democratic clothing.
Okay. All right. Jerry, thanks for the call. I get it. Carol in Arizona, I suspect you're going to take the exact opposite position.
Sort of, yeah. I thought you've been pretty hypocritical on your coverage of the presidential candidates. If anyone is anti-Hillary, they get 1, 2, 3, 4 minutes. Anybody that is for Obama gets all that time if they're anti-Hillary especially, and if they're for her, bam, they're off the phone. It's pound on Hillary, praise Obama, bad Hillary, good
Obama.
Well,
I'll tell you, Carol, my calls, and, you know, we did a straw poll on this last week, and it was, I think we had 8 votes for Hillary Clinton and 40 votes for Barack Obama, and our call ratio is coming about that rate. But, you know, well, tell me why you are supporting Hillary Clinton.
Well, she was my second choice after Edwards as well. The more I mm-hmm. listened to her, the better I liked. The more I listened to Obama, the less I liked.
Okay, what did you like about her, and what did you dislike about Obama?
Well, I'd like to say this about that young woman yesterday who said it was too hard to listen to the other talk shows.
Mm-hmm.
And when she mentioned the very worst one by name, you said, I don't talk about other shows, and you cut her off.
Yeah.
You didn't ask if she had anything else to say. And she's not the only one.
No, I understand that. But, you know, we're not doing a referendum on other talk shows here,
okay.
but we can have a referendum on or a discussion, you know, or whatever of the presidential candidates, because we are all going to vote on that, and even I'll have a vote on that, right? And you said that you support Hillary Clinton, and I respect that. And I have said, and I will say it again, if Hillary Clinton's the nominee, I will vote for her, and I will try to get her elected, you know, to the extent that
well,
I can.
And
I think that she would make a good president, and I'll put that on the record as well.
Okay.
Now, that said, here's my two questions for you, Carol, and I'd really love to get an answer to these. Number one, what is it that you like about Hillary and you don't like about Obama? And number two, I'm going to ask you the same question I just asked Jerry. If Barack Obama is the nominee, can you give me the talking points that you would use to that when you're talking to somebody else, say an uncommitted voter, to get them to vote for Obama? I'm wondering if we've become so polarized that neither side can actually even say something good about the other side.
That's where I agree with you. I will not volunteer. I will not contribute, or at this time even vote for Obama if he is the candidate. I'll vote the rest of the ballot. I won't stay home. I just won't vote the top spot.
Why?
Because I've come to so utterly despise the rest of the talk show people that have been hammering on Hillary all this time.
Yeah, but they're not, you know, there is no talk show that represents Barack Obama. I mean,
pound Hillary to the point where I can't stomach them anymore.
Well, that's fine. I mean, you know, let them know that. But that's not a reason not to vote for. That's not a reason not to vote for Barack Obama or to vote for Hillary Clinton. I mean, I'm just, you know, here you are. You're a Clinton supporter. I would love to know, and I'm saying this genuinely. I'm not, you know, there's no gotcha in this question. What is it about Hillary Clinton that really appeals to you, and what is it about Barack Obama that has offended you? Because everything up to this point has been kind of general.
Well, what's offended me is the people that back him and the way they've gone after Hillary, but she has more experience. They ran into a lot of trouble when they first got to D.C. because they hadn't been in the dirty world of D.C. politics, and they've learned how to handle them. He's only been there a couple of years. He has not really paid his political dues. He's only been a senator for a couple of years, and before that, just a state senator.
Yeah, these were the arguments that I made against Barack Obama's candidacy when I was, you know, more or less supporting. I never endorsed Edwards, but I made it fairly clear that to my listeners, I think that that's where my bias was. But okay, so continue.
You keep saying that he's not that kind of person to be dirty, and I've heard him say many nasty things.
For example.
You know what? There's so many I can't keep track of them. You know, get a senior moment or something once in a while. I just at this point it has more to do with I just can't stand the way the other people the other people have been.
Okay.
I won't vote for McCain. I would never vote for Nader under any circumstances.
So you just walk away for it.
There are two ways I would vote for Obama. If he's going to be the candidate, if Hillary comes out and says, I want you to vote for him, we've got to vote Democrat, we've got to pull a party together, I think she has the class to do that. I'm not sure he does, if she was going to be.
I think
the
they
other
both
thing
do.
Would be is if John McCain has Lieberman as a running mate.
that would
do it.
Then we're all nuts, right? Then we're in the streets. I mean, you're right. You're right.
Yeah. Well, thank you for letting me have my say on this.
You're welcome, Carol, and thank you very much for the call. This is where I really would love to hear. There are some very partisan, as I said, there's some very partisan websites out there that are taking very strong Obama or Clinton positions, and I'd love to hear them argue the opposite position. I think it would be fascinating. But as I'm asking callers, can you speak on behalf of the candidate that you don't like? If you're stuck with that candidate, can you right now just give me their elevator speech? People are like, nope, can't do that. And that says to me that this thing has gone on way too long and been way too acrimonious.
Tom Hartman, helping you win the water cooler wars. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Nine and a half minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. It's Ellen Ratner on the line with us with the Talk Radio News Service, Talk Radio News in Washington, D.C., our daily news update for the day from all things happening all around the world. Hey, Ellen, what's up?
Well, today there was a Darfur hearing that we had Jane Lute, who used to work for the military and now actually works for the United Nations, testifying, as well as the president's special envoy to the area. And there was that disagreement, you and I talked about this, about those helicopters that they couldn't get. Jane Lute and some of the Democratic senators said there is must be some reason that with all the world's resources and 190-some member countries and 192 member countries of the United Nations, that we cannot get 26 helicopters. Then the president...
The helicopters being to what? Prevent to bring food in, or to prevent the Sudanese army from bombing Darfur, or what?
Pretty much to keep watch over everything and to prevent Sudanese army, all that kind of stuff, yes. And to make sure that humanitarian aid gets to where
the stuff that you and I saw 4 weeks ago when we were there.
Exactly. And so this all was huge, and it is interesting because our very own people, Ambassador Williamson, who is the president's special representative, did not actually have anything to say, except that this was not the major issue. So here was the UN disagreeing, and our very own senators, such as Biden, disagreeing with the administration's person. So that was kind of interesting. Both said that they were, all sides said that they were actually watching slow genocide. And then several, Biden and Senator Kerry, said, look, the reason we cannot respond, and Biden said if he could, he would intervene tomorrow in this genocide, and that countries essentially, when they have genocide, they give up their ability to say, oh, no, you can't come into our country.
Right.
The genocide is such a human rights violation. And so they were very, very vocal about this, but all of them said, even if we wanted to intervene there, we couldn't because of what is going on in Iraq.
Now, okay, so we don't have the physical ability because we're so stretched, but still we're talking 30 helicopters. I mean, I think, you know, the Sudanese Air Force, that's been helping the Janjaweed is not that large. If we were to simply declare a no-fly zone over Darfur and shoot down a couple of their planes, I don't think that that's going to, you know, that we're to, in my opinion, the two things that are preventing us from doing that are the things that the president of South Sudan, the vice president of Sudan, Salva Kiir, that you and I sat with for an hour and a half in Juba in South Sudan just a month ago, that he laid out, which is Number one, that the Bush administration is in bed with Khartoum because of the so-called war on terror that the Khartoum government is sharing intelligence with them. And number two, that China is pumping oil like crazy out of South Sudan, and the United States is afraid to challenge China because China will stop buying our debt.
The Chinese weapons did come up. It is interesting that the representative from USAID said that their humanitarian workers did not approve of the no-fly zone because then the Sudan government in Khartoum would regard that as an act of war, and then nothing would get through, and that they would throw out then all the humanitarian workers. I don't know the answer to that,
yeah.
But I'll tell you, it was very.
That's a tough one because, you know, just a week after you and I left, three UN workers, humanitarian workers, driving a truckload of food, just like we were doing every day that we were there, just 15 or 20 miles from where we were murdered.
Yes, and they also said that the reason that that all of these trucks and all this are taken and people murdered is essentially because that's the only way that the rebels get their supplies.
Right. So basically, we've got this genocide that we need to do something about. And frankly, I think that we need to be, you know, Steven Spielberg, Mia Farrow is doing great work. MiaFarrow.org, by the way, her website, absolutely marvelous. In the upper right-hand corner, click on pictures. You've got a lot of good information over at TalkRadioNews.com from our trip there. But this is something that should be amenable to political pressure in the United States, and there's just not enough people talking about it.
Absolutely. Also, a couple other interesting things. The House Oversight Committee, this is Chairman Waxman's committee, had a hearing about government-funded abstinence only. He said one in four teenage girls has sexually transmitted infection. 30% of American women are pregnant before they're 20. 50% of Latina and African Americans, as if on cue, Senator Brownback said 80% of parents would like their children to abstain till they marry. Well, yeah, I'm sure they would, but what good does that have to do? And Christopher Shea is a Republican. God bless the guy. He said, young people see it, read about it. Why shouldn't they talk about it?
Yeah. And beyond that, when you look at the countries where they have frank and open and mandatory sex education in school. Yeah, Sweden, Holland, Germany, the United Kingdom. I mean, you know, right across. Actually, the UK is probably behind everybody else because they're still, like we are, suffering the echoes of crazy Queen Victoria. But, you know, the rest of Europe, you don't see these kind of statistics.
Absolutely. One other interesting thing, the Lilly Ledbetter Act, Fair Pay Act, is coming up today. As you remember, this was a Goodyear case that the Supreme said yesterday you only have 6 months from the date of pay discrimination, even though Lilly Ledbetter did not discover it until 20 years later.
Mm-hmm.
The President, we asked this morning at the White House about whether there was going to be a veto, and all Dana would say was that there's a good possibility that it's not going to get the 60 votes necessary for cloture. We think that that is going to come up at 6 p.m. today, so if you're listening, call your member of the Senate.
Call your member of the Senate and say what?
And say, please vote to get the cloture on the Lilly Ledbetter Act. Allow it to go through for an up or down vote.
Okay, so vote for an end of debate, to end debate on Lilly Ledbetter.
Exactly.
And you can go to callcongress.org and get the phone numbers for your senators. Helen, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Ellen Radner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Great newly reinvented website over there as well. By the way, to Carol, the caller who was defending Hillary Clinton in our last segment. Carol, give me a call, you know, when this all shakes out, if Obama's the candidate. I'd love to hear back from you.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? Tom Hartman Program. Tom Hartman. Talk radio for the rest of us.
Well, sometimes you know what you know, and sometimes you don't know what you know, and sometimes you don't know what you don't know, and sometimes what you do know is wrong, and sometimes everything you know is wrong.
You know that you're wrong, but you fear you're right. You suspect you're out of sync. You think that you're out of your mind.
Everything you know is wrong.
Is it possible? Well, Dr. Robert Hieronymus says, yeah, his new book, The United Symbolism of America, Deciphering Hidden Meanings in America's Most Familiar Art, Architecture, and Logos. Dr. Hieronymus, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you for having me on. You know, I greatly appreciate this, especially since we're looking at a country that seems to have been falling apart for quite some time, and especially our founders, since our founding fathers believed they were making history. They believed they were witnessing the end of oppression of a church-state alliance and government promoted by religion. And that's why they chose that new order of the ages. That was the beginning of rule by the people.
Right. Novus Seclorum, or what is it on the dollar?
Novus Ordo Seclorum is the new order of the ages. Yeah. It's not the new world order, as the Christian right would love to tell you.
Right.
As a matter of fact, today's religious right, who is currently sitting in power, have tried to rewrite this essential element of our history. They claim their authority for legislating morality according to their own narrowly defined ideas is derived from our founding fathers and so-called Christian nation that they founded. And, you know, of course, the majority were Christians to some degree, but what the founding fathers deliberately did not create was a Christian nation. They created a land of religious tolerance. So that all
they created a secular nation. The word God does not appear in the Constitution. I mean, it's pretty straightforward. Here, you're an expert on symbols, and I want to get into the question of, you know, is the secret message in the Statue of Liberty and the eye and the triangle and all that kind of stuff. But first, this is one that's really been nagging at me. The Republican Party in the year 2000, you know, there's three stars above the donkey on the Democratic Party's logo, and there's three stars above the Republican on the Republican Party's logo. And they both kind of redid their logos to make them look more 21st century, I guess, in the 2000 election. And the Republican Party flipped the stars upside down. So the five-pointed star is upside down on the Republican logo, whereas it's still right side up like it is on the flag on the Democratic Party logo. And if you Google upside down five-pointed star, what you get are all these websites about how, you know, Satan worshipers, and this is the sign of Satan, and this is the goat's head, you know, with the two pointing up are the horns, and the two side to side are the ears, and the one on the bottom is the chin, and all this kind of stuff. Why would the Republicans choose a symbol that has been associated with Satan worshiping to rebrand their own logo?
Well, first of all, the upside down five-pointed star isn't linked to Satanism in any way whatsoever.
Okay.
That's one of those stories that more or less like when they see the eye in the triangle in the pyramid, and they see that eye in the triangle, say that's Satan ruling our country.
It is Masonic, though, is it not?
No, it is not. That's the real
another myth. All right.
The forgotten founding father was Charles Thompson, Secretary of our Congress for 15 years. Mm. He is the person that originated this symbol, which featured an unfinished pyramid topped by a radiant triangle. It was an American, Charles Thompson. He originated this symbol, not the Freemasons, not Illuminati, not the Egyptians, nor the Babylonians. Before it was done by Charles Thompson, no other group had ever combined these symbols together in just such a way. And there's no indication that Thompson was a Freemason. He was friendly with the earliest group of Rosicrucians in America at the Weishaupt and Ephrata communities outside of Philadelphia, but there's no verification at all that he was a member of any secret society, especially the Freemasons. And, you know, the fundamentalist conspiratorialists, I call them, see a conspiracy of evil intentions all around us, organized by the ultimate tempter and the powerful ruling elite. And it's very unfortunate. This eye in the triangle, which symbolizes the eye of providence, has turned into, to their view, Satan ruling this country. And then they've done the same thing with the Statue of Liberty, the Liberty Bell. They say that the Liberty Bell was originated from Beelzebub, or Bel, the Lord of Baal. This is totally untrue. Has nothing to do with the Liberty Bell. Therefore, they consider the Liberty Bell to be satanic.
Yeah, it sounds like a stretch to me.
It is a huge stretch. It's a huge stretch because they didn't do their homework. They didn't go to primary sources.
So what was Charles Thompson trying to say when he combined these symbols and created the eye? Yeah, in the eye in the pyramid that we see. You know,
what he was saying is the same kind of thing Abraham Maslow, Joseph Campbell, Rollo May, and all these other individuals have said, is that human beings as a nation have a physical foundation and they have a spiritual foundation. And that physical foundation is the pyramid. It's a symbol for man's mountain. It's a symbol for mother. It's a symbol of the breast. I think we can still say breast on your show, can't we?
Sure.
Okay. It's mom. The eye in the triangle was spirit, the that which comes from above. What they were saying is that human beings and a nation is not just a physical entity. It has an immortal component. It has a spiritual destiny. And that destiny is, how does one learn from one's soul? That is, that linking of the eye and the triangle and the pyramid.
So when Charles Thompson put this symbol together for America, which is today on our dollar bills, basically it was designed to be uplifting and somewhat spiritual, but not at all religious.
Not at all religious, because I don't think religion is the same thing as spirit.
Yeah, well, religion is a political thing. It's a, you know, organization, and spirituality is a personal thing, I think.
Yeah, I agree with you, broadly speaking. I agree with you, but unfortunately, that's not how the fundamentalists see it. If you're not religious, they don't consider you spiritual.
I know, which is
upside down.
That's right. So the link between the Native Americans, the Founding Fathers, and the eagle. We've adopted the eagle as our symbol. Many Native American tribes revered eagles. Eagle feathers were used as, you know, you count coup, you know, you have a victory, you could add a feather to your bonnet, but you couldn't otherwise, things like that. So that some of the tribes, Indians. What's the link?
Well, the link with the American eagle, as you noted already, the League of the Iroquois, who heavily influenced our founding fathers, as a matter of fact, all of them, they used the symbol for the eagle as that which protects our nation. Eternal vigilance is what they were talking about. You just can't have a confederacy like they had without being careful and watching who's moving in onto your territory, whether it be physically or spiritually, and their concern was that if you don't look out for your nation from that perspective, you're going to lose it, which I think is a practicality of what we've had here in this country.
Yeah, that eagle in the seal that you see is in one claw holding arrows and in the other claw holding, what, peace?
Yes, it's a balance. That's the obverse of the front side of the great seal, and it's holding the eagle. Is holding the arrows, olive branch, to show that there is balance, that you have to balance spirit, you have to balance spirit and matter, you have to balance peace, and you have to balance that against aggression all of the time. And I'm afraid this particular administration for the past 7 years has totally imbalanced this. And I don't want to hurt your feelings or anything like that, but that's pretty much, I think, what has happened.
No, I agree with you. Absolutely. You're on a liberal talk show host. Talk show.
You know how rare you are?
I do.
What are you doing your research? Let's face it, can I get to the one real important point?
Sure.
Is that in order to understand our symbols, you got to go to primary sources.
Certainly.
Unfortunately, the internet is full of a bunch of crap up there. You know, the most important thing about knowing about who created our symbols, then you find out exactly what their beliefs were.
Yes.
And that really is something that none of the far, far right has ever done.
Yeah.
They chose to interpret the Great Seal of the United States from information that was totally inaccurate. Here's the reason why. It wasn't until 1978 that the Eagle of the Shield by the State Department was published, and it wasn't until then that we actually had the real history of the Great Seal of the United States.
Right.
You know, 'cause we were,
and that was about the time, I think 77 or 78, was when Hal Lindsey published The Late Great Planet Earth and started going off on this whole, oh my God, they're coming to get us thing, you know?
Yeah, that's right. He sure did take us for a ride on that. I made a lot of bucks there.
Yeah, sold a lot of books. I remember buying it and reading it back in the day.
A lot of other people, and of course, that spurned them into this thinking that, say, for instance, this conspiracy that there are 50 of the 56 signers of the Declaration of Independence were Freemasons. That's BS. Only 9 were.
Right.
None of the guys that designed the Great Seal of the United States were a member of any secret society.
Right, Jefferson was not. Most of them were not. And
unfortunately, that's a dictum. That's a, when I first met President Reagan, that's one of the first things he talked to me about.
Oh my.
Which is how the Freemasons, you know, this is a Freemasonic symbol, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And of course, it wasn't. And of course, I wasn't going to get 2 words in edgewise there, as you can well imagine.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and speaking of which, we're out of time here. But
can I say that the book is available in Barnes & Noble?
You may absolutely. In fact, I was going to do it for you. The website, UnitedSymbolism of America.com. And the book, of course, is, where to go? Here it is. The United Symbolism of America, Deciphering Hidden Meanings in America's Most Familiar Art, Architecture, and Logos. and Dr. Robert Hieronymus, the author. Thank you, sir, for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. 16 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. News without conflicts of global corporate interest. The Tom Hartman Program.
And I'm taking my country back. Boys, you ain't been doing it right. Oh, I've been watching you and I don't like how you've been treating my stars and stripes. You took our jobs and some overseas. Now we owe billions to the red Chinese. You blew the budget and you botched Iraq. So I'm taking my country back.
One voter at a time, one district at a time, one state at a time, one city at a time. We are taking our country back. And as we did 2 years ago, and as we did 4 years ago, and as we did 6 years ago, in the run-up to an election, we want to feature some progressive candidates out there who really have the opportunity to make a difference, who, even though they may not be living in your backyard or representing your district, you should be considering supporting. Dan Seals, for example, he's a business consultant, adjunct professor at Northwestern University, a progressive Democrat who is running in Illinois. Dan Seals, Seals, forforcongress.com, his website. Dan, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me on, Tom.
Great to have you with us. Your district looks to me like it's just like the northern suburbs of Chicago. Is that, would that be a good way to say it?
Yeah, that's right. It's just north of Chicago. For those who've been here, it starts a little north of Northwestern University and kind of just goes right up the lake.
Right up the lake, yeah. And Dan Seals, who are you running against, and what's the history of that district?
So I'm running against a fellow named Mark Kirk. He is the incumbent. And the history of this district is pretty interesting. This district used to be represented by Rumsfeld, of all people.
Holy cow.
Yeah, tell me about it. But
you're going to have to perform an exorcism when you get in there.
Oh, I mean, you had to have the whole place sanitized.
Right.
But I tell you, what's happened over the years is, as the district has expanded and different people have moved out to the suburbs, we've seen the demographics and the politics of the district changed. So starting with Bill Clinton's second term, this district started voting Democratic, and now it's one of only eight districts left in the country that votes Democratic on the presidential level, but that has a Republican representing it. And this is a Republican who just voted to allow waterboarding, has been not only a strong advocate of this war, but has voted eight times against getting out. He was quoted in the Chicago Tribune when he went to visit President Bush in the White House to talk about the war. He was quoted as saying, not that we should stay the course in the war or that we should change the course in the war, but that the war was hurting his reelection chances, and it absolutely is. This district is passionately against this conflict and our behavior in managing it.
We're talking to Dan Seals. Dan Seals for Congress, F-O-R, Congress, Seals spelled just the way you'd think, S-E-A-L-S. DanSealsForCongress.com, his website. I'm looking at your website. It's a great, very nice website. And Dan, and you're running against a Republican incumbent. You took, what, 80% of the vote in the Democratic primary? You've got that under your belt.
Right.
And this is going to be a tight race, I understand, from the polling.
Yeah, this should be a...
It's always tough going up against an incumbent.
It's never easy. I tell you, I ran in 2006, frankly, without the support of the Democratic Party or the respect of the Republican one. I was a homegrown grassroots candidate, just going door to door, holding small events in people's homes. But somehow we managed to bring out 2,600 people. We were able to raise a good sum of money, and I won 47% of the vote.
Wow.
In 2006, again, with no support. We now have support, we have respect, and they're already coming after me, from the state Republican Party. But we haven't changed our message. You've got to change the direction of this country. As you say, we've got to take this country back, and this is how it's going to happen. It's going to happen one voter, one community, one district, one state at a time.
So for the 10th District of Illinois, the northern suburbs of Chicago heading up the lake there that you want to represent, Dan Seals, what are the issues that are at the top of your list?
Well, I tell you, there are three big ones, and I suspect they are what you're hearing about a lot as well. It's the war in Iraq. We've got to change course there. It's health care. We've got to get costs down to make them more affordable for more Americans. I think that we need to view health care as a right, not just a privilege. And then the economy. And you know, look, there are no silver bullets with this economy. We have some tough choices to make and a lot of work that we have to do, whether it's getting costs down for average Americans. And, I think about the middle class in particular with the costs of education, of health care, gas, even food now skyrocketing. It's just becoming harder and harder.
Well, to some extent, all those costs would be no problem at all if we still had decent-paying jobs.
Well, exactly.
You know?
Right?
It's like, I don't mind paying you. People say, change trade agreements, you're not going to get cheap stuff at Walmart. Hey, if I've got a decent job, I'll pay a little more for the stuff I'm buying. I got no problem with that.
And instead, what we see is household income is actually down since the Bush administration came in. It's just incredible.
Personal it's down since Reagan came in. I mean, that's really when it began.
Now you're talking.
Yeah. Yeah, there you go. I mean, that's really when it began. I mean, this, all of this voodoo economics, it started to some extent, even Jimmy Carter was, his deregulation stuff the last couple of years of his administration. But it really began with Reagan, and it's just gone downhill from there. Dan Seals, running for Congress, even if you're not in the 10th District of Illinois, get over there, send him a couple of bucks and help him out. Dan Seals for Congress, the website, danseelsforcongress.com. Dan, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you so much, Tom.
Good talking with you. Good luck.
Thank you.
Check back in with us after the election.
You got it.
Thank you. 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
I hope the days come easy and the moments pass slow, and each road leads you where you wanna go. And if you're faced with a choice and you have to choose, I hope you choose the one that means the most to you. And if one door opens to another door closed, I hope you keep on walking till you find the window. If it's cold outside, show the world the warmth of your smile. But more than anything,
more than anything, let's get involved in this democracy. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Larissa Alexandrovna, one of the finest investigative journalists working in the entire United States. I would argue one of the finest investigative journalists on earth. Most of her writing appearing over at rawstory.com is on the line with us. Larissa, welcome to the program.
Thank you, and oh my God, thank you for that.
It's true. It is true. Investigative journalism is like a dying or dead art, and you do it so well.
Well, thank you.
It's just so important that people be reading your stuff, your work. The work that you did on the Siegelman case, and now we've got Diaz and Miner. And first of all, let's just bring us up to date on what's going on with Don Siegelman. I've been pounding this drum on this show for a long, long time. I think you were the person who first brought my attention to it. And where's he at right now? Where's his case at? Let me just start out by framing this for our listeners. This is why we need to look at the attorneys, the U.S. attorneys that did not get fired.
Right.
Because they are being used by this administration, or in many cases they are aggressively promoting themselves to be used by this administration to further partisan political ends, to create Karl Rove's permanent Republican majority, which in the Soviet Union was called the Politburo. And they're doing this using the law in a ways that, in my opinion, are not only unconstitutional but are also illegal. So, Don Siegelman, you can give us a thumbnail recap of the case and then tell us where it's at.
Well, basically, a thumbnail recap is that he was a Democratic governor of Alabama, and the allegations are that during the 2002 campaign, for him to keep his seat, he was running against a guy by the name of Bob Riley, a Republican. And there were concerns that Riley couldn't beat him. There were concerns regarding vote rigging in a particular county. And there were concerns that Siegelman wouldn't be quiet about it. So ultimately, the U.S. attorney who is married to Siegelman's opponent's campaign advisor, basically indicted Siegelman, and the rest they say is history. He was not only indicted once but twice on two separate occasions, and right before the second election. And anyway, he was sent straight to jail without.
Couldn't even post bond. He couldn't appeal. And
right.
what he was convicted of was putting a guy on the board that overlooks hospitals, which is an unpaid position. A guy who'd
right.
been in that position twice before, appointed
uh-huh.
by previous governors, and for which, I mean, nobody made any money on this thing. And
right.
the guy had made a contribution to a fund to create a lottery in Alabama to raise money for schools. None of that went to Don Siegelman, and somehow
or his campaign,
and somehow this U.S. prosecutor said that this was bribery.
Well, they had coached a witness in the case, and another one was of dubious character. Well, they were both actually of dubious characters.
Right.
There was surely tampering. The judge on the case had his own issues. Anyway, it's fairly complex, but the current status is that when Don Siegelman appeared on Dan Abrams' MSNBC show, The Verdict, he was calling on Karl Rove to testify.
Right. And Rove's lawyer, sure.
Robert Luskin, basically issued a comment saying, well, that, you know, yes, we will testify. And he was insulted because the implication was that there was something to hide, and he was insulted by the whole notion. But when Congress did finally ask Rove to testify, because they're investigating.
This is John Conyers, right?
Right. Yeah. Rove basically said no, and then wrote Dan Abrams a huge 5-page letter where he, you know, didn't answer a single question.
Hysterical screed is what it was.
Yeah,
it was.
I mean, he's definitely in a panic. That's, you know, certainly what I'm hearing from the people I've talked to. And
well, he's looking at going to jail.
Well, I think of all the scandals he's been involved in, this is the one that's going to get him.
Karl Rove could go to prison for this.
Yeah. Well, unless he's pardoned.
Yeah.
Then,
oh, man.
You know, then all bets are off. But, you know, he appears again in Mississippi, in the situation involving judges in Mississippi, too.
Yeah, so let's tell us about these. The minor case and the Diaz case, these two Mississippi judges and two other Mississippi judges, excuse me?
Right, there's altogether, there were three Mississippi judges. One is a Supreme Court Mississippi judge by the name of Oliver Diaz. Paul Minor is this really famed plaintiff's attorney who took on Big Tobacco. And basically what he did... What happened in Mississippi is Paul Minor did not break the law, essentially. He basically gave loan guarantees to the judges and all sorts of other candidates, which is not illegal in Mississippi,
right.
to cover their campaign expenses because they were...
Because they run for election.
Well, right, but they were, exactly, I'm sorry, judges do run for election in Mississippi. But they were, you know, the opposition... was the U.S. Chamber of Commerce that basically came into the state and did this huge money dump on the behalf of the Republican-supported judges. So he basically was helping judges and others out, and he had done so for years, which is not a crime.
Right.
In any case, so the four of these were, individuals were all indicted, and Diaz was tried twice and acquitted both times. Minor was found guilty and sent straight to prison. Wasn't, just like Siegelman, wasn't allowed out on appeal, wasn't given time to get his, you know, life in order before he went off to prison, was shackled just like, Siegelman, which is uncommon in a white case crime, and...
White collar crime, yeah.
I'm sorry, what did I say?
Doesn't matter.
I'm sorry, just going on and on. White collar crime. Okay, sorry. So he's been there for about 2 years, and during this whole time, his wife has developed cancer, Minor's wife, and she is gravely ill, and he's not being allowed out to see her, let alone out to see her.
Another marvelous politically motivated prosecutor. And in the case of Diaz, after he was acquitted, didn't they then come kick his door in?
Well, during one of his trials, his house was robbed, just like Siegelman's, just like Minor's, just like Siegelman's.
Yeah, so there's a pattern here.
Yes.
Not just a pattern of prosecutorial misconduct, not just a pattern of stealing elections, as I'm of the opinion happened against Don Siegelman to begin with. That's what started this whole thing, was he was blowing the whistle on, oh, gee, in the middle of the night we found a bunch of votes. I guess Riley is going to be the governor now.
Right.
I mean, that was what started the whole thing, was Riley stealing the election, in my opinion. And you know, I realize that the facts of that are still in debate because it's never been audited, to the best of my knowledge.
That's right. But, because the ballots were sealed.
That's right. By the Republicans.
Right, exactly.
Oh, we're not going to look at those ballots.
And the guy who sealed the ballots, who was then the Alabama Attorney General, was then appointed on a recess appointment to a federal bench, to the 11th right. Circuit. So... yeah, it's fairly.
So now John Conyers is looking into this stuff?
Well, yeah, my understanding is that he is. I don't know.
But he's being stonewalled.
Well, he's always been stonewalled. This entire administration is basically stonewalling everybody on everything.
Is there anything that our listeners can do to support any of these folks or to pressure their elected representatives to say, please look into what's going on down there in Siegelman and Diaz and Minor? I mean, all these cases that you, Larissa Alexandrovna, are writing about over at rawstory.com. People can read the articles there. Call our elected officials.
Yes, demand that the media cover this. I mean, the Siegelman thing wasn't covered for a very long time. It was just basically me and Scott Horton out in the bushes by ourselves, you know?
Right.
And
then when it was covered, it was, you know, Dan Abrams, and it was a 2 days. Well, 60 Minutes did a thing on it, too.
Yeah, but that was blacked out in Alabama.
That's right.
That's right, right? So, but basically, it's Dan Abrams, and that's it. Nobody else is talking about this. The question is why. These are American citizens. This is, don't they deserve a fair trial? I mean, in all honesty, should they be investigated because of their political leanings or because they're Republicans who won't play ball?
Well, I understand even in the Diaz case that his wife was threatened that she had to testify against her husband or they would take away her children.
Right. They were basically, they didn't have any case. In fact, here you have the federal government coming into the state where there no law has been broken and claiming mail fraud in order for them to justify why they're there.
Right.
And
a federal crime.
Right, exactly. And they basically were trying to get something out of her, and so they basically threatened to take her children away if she did not.
And this is the guy who was acquitted.
Yeah, he was acquitted twice.
Twice.
That's right.
I mean, this is...
And his house was broken into. That's right.
Right, and this is all coming out of the Justice Department. This is all coming out of Mukasey's Justice Department. This is all... Actually, it was all coming out of Alberto Gonzalez's John Ashcroft's Justice Department.
More importantly, this was all coming out of the White House, too, in the form of Karl Rove.
Right, who was back there pulling the strings and deciding who was going to get appointed to where and who was going to get fired because they wouldn't do this kind of stuff.
Exactly.
Larissa Alexandrovna, the finest investigative journalist in the world. No, I'm not exaggerating. Rawstory.com. No, I'm not. Rawstory.com. You can check it out. Larissa, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
It is always great talking with you and reading your work.
Thank you.
45 minutes past the hour. 866-303-2270. Our telephone number, TomHartmann.com, AirAmerica.com.
Tom Hartmann. Uncommon sense from the radical middle. This is the Tom Hartmann Program.
You're not alone. I never thought I'd find the road to freedom. Never thought I'd see you smile again.
Welcome back to the Tom Hartmann Program, powered in part by Teamsters for Change. It's time for a change in Washington. You can find out more at teamster.org. And speaking from behind the good old working-class stainless steel microphone here, the most labor-friendly program in the world. 1-866-303-2270, Mike in Arlington, Washington. Hey, Mike, what's on your mind?
Tom, good morning. The media often says that Obama can't be elected because he can't put Hillary away.
I've never heard the media say that. I've heard the Clinton campaign say that. But
But you know,
but the math doesn't say that.
But you know, the thing is, it seems like Hillary can't put Obama away. She started first, and she started with more money.
Right.
So it seems like she can't put Obama away.
She started not just with more money. She started with name recognition, you know, which costs a lot of money to get, and a huge lead. She had more than a 20-point lead in Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
You know, way back. Yeah. What you just described, Mike, is fundamentally reframing the frame.
Right.
Interesting and well said, because the frame that's being put out, even the New York Times today. Oh, gee, you know, Obama just can't shake Clinton. Well, you know, let's flip it around. Clinton started out this. That's a very interesting take on it. I'm good on you. Ben in Newburgh, New York. Hey, Ben, what's up?
Yeah, hi. You know, I want to comment on Hillary's bellicose attitude yesterday on an interview about Iran, and particularly how her words could have been twisted and how it could be an object lesson for Hillary supporters, and quoting people out of context. Yesterday she made a quote. It was an entire sentence that said, I want the Iranians to know that if I'm the president, we will attack Iran. And then she goes on to say, in the next 10 years, during which they might foolishly consider launching an attack on Israel, we would be totally able to obliterate them, blah, blah, blah. It makes it sound like even their considering would score retaliation. But the point I really want to make is that those words were very dangerous words because they upset things in the real world. In fact, some have speculated that they may have already contributed to the spike in oil prices. There's an interesting article in the Wall Street Journal to that effect. But more importantly, this is what I want people to take away from that. If I or any other Obama were to continuously repeat the words, if Hillary is president, we will have a war in Iran, over and over, and base a whole ad campaign on it, they would say, oh, look, you're taking her out of context, you're twisting her words in her meaning. Yet on something far, far, far less important, without any real-world impact, I'm talking about the bitterness nonsense, they were able to use that exact tactic. So maybe they would understand if we were to do that to them just a little bit. You know, I know that Hillary is not going to foolishly attacked.
But see, that's the thing. The Obama campaign has had so many opportunities to stick the knife in, and because so many easy opportunities. You know, the one I mentioned, just you know, referring to Bill's affairs during the debate, for example. So many easy, and Barack Obama will not do it because he's really committed, and I have come to believe that he actually is really committed to a new kind of politics, so you know, the question is. Well, because in all probability, he is going to be the Democratic nominee. The question is, will that new kind of politics, so far it's working against Hillary Clinton, even though, you know, I say, you know, she won Pennsylvania yesterday by between 9 and 10 points. That, you know, I don't consider that a major win, that, you know, given everything that happened. But you know, will that new type of politics work against John McCain? And that's the question that nobody knows the answer to. And I would like to see the Clinton campaign throw the kitchen sink at John McCain, and I'd like to see the Obama campaign throw the kitchen sink, or whatever metaphor that they're using. I use that metaphor because that's one that Mark Penn had used, Clinton's advisor, at John McCain. And, you know, let's see what happens. Let's see what happens. Tim, and thanks for the call. Tim in Detroit, listening on WDTW. You can give the elevator speech for Hillary?
I am, and I am an Obama supporter. Let me say that. But, yes, I think Hillary Clinton could be McCain, and I would say, number one, she's got a good health care plan. It has mandates in it. Those are required. We have 47 million Americans that are uninsured.
You're absolutely right. And, by the way, that's, in my mind, one of her strongest points. And that's one of the things that she will be beaten over the head with, is that she's going to garnish your paycheck.
Yeah, that it's
mandated.
She does somehow, when she's got to make that point, though, that she's not going to raise taxes. And you don't have to raise taxes to have that plan.
No.
Number two, she's actually said she's agnostic on the nuclear issue. And actually, I like that because she's not committed to building more nuclear plants. I think she can use that as a positive.
Right, and Barack Obama has been an advocate of nuclear power in the past.
Now, number three, and I believe her on this point, whatever her rhetoric on other points, that she's committed to the green economy. I think she wants to bring jobs back to the U.S., And this time,
I think any politician wants to.
Yeah, we need a green economy in Detroit badly. So.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so that's the elevator speech. Those three major points, Tim.
Yes.
In your opinion. Okay, thank you very much. That's great. See, I mean, there's. I'll let you say it. John in Los Angeles. Hey, John.
Hi. Like the last caller, I have three points that I'd like to make about this ridiculous electability consideration. The first point is, to all the listeners, if you vote for someone because you think they're electable rather than because they're who you want, I guarantee you, you'll never get what you want.
Yeah, absolutely.
Number two. Huh?
Go ahead.
Yeah, I want to keep this quick for you. Number two, electability is the same as non-electability. You mentioned, Tom, about Ralph Nader, and in the past you've mentioned about Dennis Kucinich not being electable, therefore not voting for them. That is also erroneous thinking. Number three, the reason why electability, I think, is just as much a wedge or divisive as race or gender is because it divides each individual voter from voting their conscience.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you, John, although, you know, we have to acknowledge the political system we have. And just for the record, I've not said that Dennis Kucinich was unelectable, and in fact, I even donated money to his campaign. Coming up tomorrow, I'll confront Jim Trippin, editor-in-chief of China Stock Digest and author of Becoming Your Own China Stock Guru, about why he thinks boycotting the Olympics is a big mistake. I think it's a good plan. Ed Begley Jr. drops by to talk about Living Green, something he's doing very well, plus the best of the rest of the news and your calls right here on the Tom Hartman Program. Don't forget, democracy begins with you, activism begins with you. Tag, you're it! Get out there, get active. We'll see you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit TomHartmanRadio.com.